This is tape two, side one, of the oral history interview of Irvin I. Rubin on February 26, 2002.
And then, as far as Robinson Plastics was concerned, I had 21%. I ended up at no expense to have 50%, and Chatham and Lighting Parts had 25% each. Then, in 1966, Nat Kirschenbaum, K-I-R-S-C-H-B-A-U-M, was a very wealthy man. He owned banks in California and so on and so forth. And we were driving through, my wife and I were visiting them out there, because I would go and visit. He distributed our lamp parts there. I would visit our distributors several times a year. And she says to her husband, she said, "Nat, dear, they left the lights on in your bank again." He was preparing his estate plan, and his planners wanted him to get rid of all the small investments because that would cause a lot of problems when he died. So he told us that any time we had an agreement how to get out, he would be glad to get out. And in 1966, he did go out. The company bought his stock, so I essentially owned two-thirds of the business and Chatham at one-third. And in 1972, Chatham went out of the business and I ended up owning the whole business. That is the financial development of the business. I sold the lamp parts business, I'll tell you the reason why, and I always characterized it as a kind of a business that a very wealthy man would buy for a stupid son-in-law, because we'll talk about the lamp part business in a minute. It was solid, the biggest in the country, with the best reputation in the country, and I sold it for close to $1 million. But the injection molding I couldn't sell, because the injection molding basically are coming to me for my knowledge. And I finally closed that down in 2001. Let me talk a minute about what Robinson Plastics did. Robinson Plastics made plastic lamp parts. They made finials, that's the part you screw on top of the lamp to hold the shade down, and they made prisms. And that was a very good business at the time, because the amount of lamp parts used in it, just phenomenal. The largest order we ever got was for 1 million finials from the Loren Company. They were in the Green Stamp program and a couple of other programs. And 1 million finials is an awful lot. Matter of fact, the only time Mabern ever called, because it was too cheap to do anything else, but the reason they called was, could we make the finials fast enough? And I told them we could make them faster than they can assemble them. I had machines running incredible numbers of prisms. I'll give you the exact numbers from here. And we couldn't keep it, with two machines running, we couldn't keep the country supplied. And when glass became more expensive, a glass prism than a lamp prism, a plastic lamp prism, we back ordered sometimes for months. We put them on court on allocation. And I couldn't get a Robinson to build another mold, but that's another story. We were the only, one of the five or six injection molders, so that any questions that came to potential customers that came to Roman Haas, from whom we were buying the acrylic, they would give to us as well to the other molders. And one was from Petit Musée. They were art people, and they were making a beautiful plastic bookend. And the bookend consisted of the plastic god of Apollo. And they took an alabaster column and an alabaster base, hollowed it out, put in a battery and bulb, and the reflection was really a museum piece. Gorgeous. But their problem was they couldn't hand carve. It took them a week to hand carve one piece. So he came to Robinson and asked, could we mold it? And he calls me out of the shop. And I said, I really don't know, but if you could engrave the reverse on two pieces of steel, I'll try it. So they said, okay. I said, there's a steel yard not too far away. Do you want me to get the steel now? He said, no, I came by subway. I'll come by car tomorrow. So the next morning I went over there and I told him the size steel I wanted. And it was about 6 by 6 by 6, two pieces ground flat. And they said, fine. I said, how much? I paid them. They said, do you want us to deliver? I said, no. I'll carry it. I bought two pieces of rope. A dead silence. And they go in the back and they tie the rope on and they bring it out on a flatbed. And I go to lift it up, and of course I can't raise the thing, and I became hysterical. So they put it on a hand truck, we were a couple blocks away, and delivered it. And I don't know, maybe a month and a half later, or less, he came back with the two pieces of steel. And I never heard of a lathe, I never heard of any machine tool except the drill press. And with the drill press, I built a mold around the part, and I was ready to try it, and the Petit Musée said, let me send my chief mechanic over the watch. We put it in and it worked. We had flash around the edges and he showed me how to correct the flash. You put artist blue on one side, close the machine, open it up, and where it touched, the blue would transfer. So we'd hand grind off that till it all turned blue. And then he took it back and he put in good leader pins, that's what keeps them all aligned and watered the way it's supposed to be. And he told me about, took me a walk to Center Street, showed me lathes and milling machines and so on. And as a reward for this, incidentally, we bought an Atlas lathe, which I now have in my basement here in the house. We molded the part, and we had it at a minute cycle. So I had it at 60 shots per hour. Robinson figured it cost him $12 to make one, so he'll charge him $7. And they got the piece, and all they had to do was buff away the parting line. That's where the two halves met. And you couldn't tell the difference between that and a hand-carved one. I was a very naive young man. And West 40th Street, where we were, between 8th and 10th Avenue, was the red light, one of the red light districts in New York. And I would walk home at night, because I would work till midnight sometimes, and all these beautiful girls would sit on a stoop and wave to me and talk to me, and they got to know my name and so on. Upstairs, when I was running the night shift, I would look out the window, and these girls were bringing their men to the brownstones, and I borrowed my mother's opera glasses. And everything I've ever read in my whole life, I had seen over there. But if it was really interesting, they had a traveling goat. I'd sometimes watch too long, and when I opened the machine, I couldn't get the part out. I had to chip it out. Fine. It was such a job chipping, I never got caught too often. About 3 or 4 months, well, less than that, about 2 months after we're running, Mr. Plume, the plastic salesman for Roman Haas, comes in and he sees the hand-finished God Apollo on Robinson's desk. He says, boy, if you could get rid of the undercut, that would be a great part to mold. So Robinson calls me in. I had known Mr. Plume, introduces me again, and he says, Mr. Plume said, if you remove the undercut, we could mold it. Well, I said, what do I do with the 15,000 pieces we've already molded? So Plume looks at me, and Robinson gets pretty mad. So we went in the back to see it. And what happened was, in a minute, it's a very thick piece, almost an inch thick. When I took it out, it was soft, and then it cooled on the table. But because it was soft, the head knocked down to get rid of the undercut, tilted, and that gave a line in the back, which I thought was muscle. So if I let it cool too much, it wouldn't flex, because it was too hard, then I had to chip it out. So the great God Apollo taught me about number one, undercuts, and number two, about sex. one of the people very well known and active in selling lamp parts was Walter Freeman, F-R-E-E-M-A-N. And one day he came to Mr. Robinson and me. He heard of a process called vacuum metallizing, where you could get it finished like brass. And he thought it would be a great idea if we could copy the brass parts, because all the lamp parts, the way a lamp is built is you have a base, a 1/8 inch iron pipe in the middle, and you drop things on the pipe and then screw a socket on the top. With a harp, that's what would hold the shade. And he thought that if we could make it out of plastic and make it look like brass, it would be a lot cheaper and he could really make a killing. The answer was yes, it would be a lot cheaper. So he told me of a company, Vacuum Metallizing Corp. in Greenpoint. And I went to see them and I spoke to them. I went back to Walter and I told him my suggestion would be to take two of the largest selling parts and we'll make two cavity mold, one of each, and we'll go and try and see if the process works, which we did. And The owner was a man by the name of Mesberg, and he knew very little technically, but he had two people there, Alan Schlafmetz, now Alan Shore, and Paul Gang. And Paul was the expert on vacuum metallizing. The process is very simple. You take a plastic part and you put it on a holder which rotates so that the part will, all of the part will eventually face the center of the machine. The machine is a big tube. And what you do is in the center there, there's a bar of tungsten, a wire, tungsten wire, which heats up aluminum so that the aluminum vaporizes like water would vaporize when you boil it. And then you would be turning the insides so that two or three molecules of aluminum would deposit all over and it looked just like chrome. You had to put on a lacquer coat before you started because if not the plastic would start to gas out. It was a very, very, very low vacuum. And then you take it out, it would rub off with your finger, so you put on a top coat of acrylic or whatever. And then if you wanted it brass, you dyed it brass. Well, there were a lot of technical problems there in adhesion. There were some technical problems in the dye. But with my knowledge of chemistry and Alan's knowledge of the process, we eventually got a coating which worked, which you couldn't rub off with your finger. And later a company, B Chemical, came over and they started manufacturing it for other people. And it became, just let it ring. We ultimately came up with a coating. And it was so successful technically that Walter went and had molds built for these parts. He tried to sell them and he couldn't sell them because what was good for my father and good for my grandfather, good for my great-grandfather, brass, was perfect. Then, fortunately for us, came the Korean War where they couldn't get brass, so they forgot about their grandfather. And the price difference was tremendous. A 6-inch break, that's what they're called, B-R-E-A-K, in brass, cost close to $3.50, plus it's very heavy, and it tarnished. We sold the same part, identical, in plastic, vacuum metallized, for 25 cents. That led to a very interesting, of course, they all people used it, because, you know, if they couldn't get brass, they were going to take plastic. That put us on a map, we built a lot of other molds for them, and so on. But that caused another problem. People who bought lamps saw the plastic part never tarnished. So they went back to the store, the Gimbel's, Macy's, and so on, and says, hey, we want lamps where we don't have to polish. So what they had to do is they had to metallize the metal parts instead of plating them, because they would take steel, plated brass. So now they just took steel, vacuum metallized it so it wouldn't tarnish. That's why Chatham Metal Spinning, who made the metal parts, had a vacuum metallizing factory. And that's what made the deal interesting to me, because we needed more capacity than we could get. One of the people who was supplying us with vacuum metallizing, and vacuum metallizers were not too many of them, in Jersey, he decided that he could make more money vacuum metallizing glass bottles. But he didn't realize that glass bottles came in a huge amount of hay. They're very expensive to handle, and unless you clean them perfectly, you'd see the little bits of hay and it wouldn't get a smooth finish and so on. And consequently, he was not able to take care of us the way we had to have it. And the foreman, Jose Hernandez, H-E-R-N-A-N-D-E-Z, he came from one of the, he came from Puerto Rico. Remarkably nice guy. Came to me on the phone one day. He said, look, you're never going to get your parts. I found a small plant, which is enough for you. You buy it, I'll run it for you. And he gave me the statistics, the economics on it, and so on. I said, no way. I said, you're going to buy it because I don't want to own any more plants. He said, I have no money. I said, you don't need any money. I will give you a Robinson Plastics guarantee so that you can get all the money you want. And that's what happened. He got we were rated B+1, which is a very high rating. So there was no problem with the bank setting up the money. And eventually, he paid us back in merchandise, and when he needed money, I would lend it to him. And you won't find a better supplier than that. And he's done remarkably well. He's got ranches all over the Caribbean and so on and so forth. As you can gather, custom molding became a very important part of our business, and before long it was bigger than the Lampart business. Profit-wise, it was about the same. We never sold. Our attitude in selling, or my attitude in selling injection molded parts, was number one, you'd make more money spending time improving your own business than trying to save a few cents on a molded part. Number two, just like a doctor, when you put your life in his hands, you're putting your business life in the hands of the molder. Because if he doesn't know his business, you can get an awful lot of rejects and problems. And I would explain that for a nickel lamp part, if it fails, the lamp comes back, of course, the manufacturer of $20, $30, $40 with a lot of dissatisfaction. So that we don't make perfect parts, we just try to ship them. And we did. And we had a great quality control system and people who had incentive to make good parts. And we had no problem getting customers who really wanted good parts and were willing to pay for it. Getting back to lamp parts again. My son was in the business for a while, but it was not his cup of tea. He had a master's in engineering from Cornell, an MBA from Connecticut, and he just didn't like the 44 different things happened at one time. So he married a very lovely lawyer, and he became a lawyer. But he came up with an idea for new parts. The lamp industry used a lot of metallized tubing as part of the lamp. And he said, why metallize it, which is very difficult? Why don't we hot stamp it? Nobody had done that. And I'm sorry, they weren't using metallized, they were using metal parts, polished. So I went to Kensall, a very large hot stamping machinery and manufacturer, and he and I worked out a system where we could take a round tube and hot stamp it, and it looked just like you couldn't tell the difference from metal. But we also could use any kind of hot stamp material, and we used one of marble. And we couldn't sell it because customers would think it was marble, they'd find out it's plastic and say they were gypped. So we had to cut that out of the line. The first custom molding job we got was somebody came in with Petit Muse with the great god Apollo. Then somebody came in and wanted us to mold acetate over a wooden form for a toilet seat. So I did. No, nobody told me I shouldn't. And he sold it to Sears. And one day we get a letter from him, the customer, that Sears is complaining that the toilet seat is not resistant to lipstick. So Robinson turned it over to me, and of course you're too expensive to call. So I wrote a letter. He was the chief of the quality control division of Sears, a huge operation. I got to know it later. And I said, with all due respect, our marketing people never put the possibility of people, women kissing toilet seats on their agenda. He wrote back, if the marketing people had some ability, they would notice that above toilet seats are medicine cabinets which have mirrors, and that women make up using the mirrors, and sometimes the lipstick falls and hits the toilet seat, and that transfers to the human body, and I still can't convince my wife of what happened. So I turned it over to Eastman, and the only other material that would be good would be butyrate, but that has bad odor. So they got a hold of Sears and they settled it. And he wrote back to me what they did, just forgot about it and didn't worry about it. And he invited me to see him. And when I came to Chicago, and the lamp shows were in Chicago at that time, and when I would go occasionally, Robinson would take me. I would stop over, he showed me the place, just a fantastic place, and we became pretty good friends. Before I left Robinson, to go to Montrose Chemical, we got a request to make a plastic part for the Norden bomb site, which I was later told the first plastic part that they really used. The bomb site contained a galena crystal, G-A-L-E-N-A, and they put a whisker on it. And then they, because it would shake off, they poured tar in it. And if the tar was poured incorrectly and it moved the whisker, they couldn't use it. So we made a clear butyrate part, which withstood the tar, the chemical effect of the tar, and they could see whether the whisker moved or not. I wanted to see what it fit, because I know from experience, you got to know what you're doing. They said it's restricted. So the part was about 2 inches diameter, and I think it was 2 inches plus or minus 15 thousandths. So I made my part minus 15, and the metal part was plus 15, so of course it didn't fit. So we remade the plastic part. But that was one of my first experiences with the government and plastic. But that wasn't the government, that was for Norden. But I'll tell you two more. One was during the Korean War, we got a request for a very small nylon part with a 5/16 hole in the center. The outside diameter had a plus or minus of 1/10,000 tolerance in nylon, virtually impossible to do. So what I thought of doing is molding 100 parts. I said maybe I'd get two good parts out of it, and I priced it accordingly, plus the cost of inspection. We get the job, because no molder in his right mind would ever think of doing that. And then I called up the contracting officer, and I asked him how was he going to measure the nylon. You know, you're talking about a tenth of an inch, this is not much. He says, with a ruler. I said, would you please send me a ruler like that, because in New York we don't have such rulers. He says, what are you talking about? I said, I can't mold measure a tenth of thousandths of an inch with a wooden ruler. He says, you're crazy. And he looked at the print. He says, it should have been plus or minus 10,000ths. I said, okay, then I can measure with a ruler. He started laughing. He says, by the way, how much are you getting for it? I quoted $1.25 a piece. And I said, I'm only in the engineering department, sir. He said, well, you get off your behind and find out fast. Which, of course, I called him back and I gave him the price. He says, that's ridiculous. I said, okay, let me refigure it. So I refigured it at about 45 cents. The whole thing wasn't worth more than 15. He said, you're a gentleman. And he said, okay. So we made a small fortune on that. And then we had another occasion. Well, we had two occasions. But where during the Vietnamese War, I was always against it in principle. And somebody came to me to make a Fresnel lens. That's a lens. Well, if you don't know what it is, look it up in the dictionary. But it was about a foot in diameter. And it was about over an inch and a quarter thick. And the reason they needed that was either the Russians or the Chinese gave the North Vietnamese infrared sensors so they could see where our battleships were and where our landing strips were. So they needed the infrared so the pilots could land at night. So they wanted this lens which would have the infrared only going horizontally, and they would cover the top. They tried it in glass, but it didn't work. So I got a call from a molder. Would I make it for him? I said, no, go to somebody else because I'm not interested in the war. Well, I said, we went to DuPont and Roman Haas, the only makers of the, it had to be an acrylic, because that's the best weathering material we have. You look at the signs outside for Texaco and so on and so forth, at gas stations, some of them lasted 50, 60 years. They said the only guy in the country who would do it would be me. So I said, I don't give a damn, and I hung up. About 20 minutes later, I got a phone call, and the person said, are you Mr. Rubin? I said, yes. He said, write this number down, a telephone number. He said, I'm an assistant secretary of the Navy. We need this, and he told me why. He said, if you don't do it, you'll be out of business and you'll be in jail. He said, we'll plant stuff in your house, we'll raid your house, we'll give an IRS on your business, and you're finished. So I said my piece, and he said, thank you, and hung up. And I spoke to my family and my lawyer and accountant. And obviously, they said, you're helping American lives, so go ahead and try and do it. So he called me back about a week later, and I said, you win. And then I went back to DuPont, And I said, you got me into this, get me out of it, because I don't know how many pounds of material I'm going to need, you know, to make it work. And they gave us unlimited material for experimental purposes. And we built a half a mold because they needed it so badly. Take too long to build a whole mold. And then we didn't have enough capacity to fill the part. So we rewired our machine so that the screw would continually turn till the part was filled. And then we'd change the hydraulic system so the screw would force material in and maintain the pressure, which I think is the first time it was ever done. And then we dropped the part right from the machine into hot water to let it anneal. Then we had a problem when we cemented it. There were stress marks because of with a solvent cement, which was the only cement that would hold in this case. So Bruce Buckner, who ran the plant, one of the smartest men I ever met, he took dips that they use to coat when they're shipping, say, a drill bit, a plastic tip, and he just cut it off so the only thing that was under the cement only reached the parts that were cemented. And we held them in a clamp together like that and air annealed that, and it worked like a charm. Then the final thing with the government was very funny. The government was looking for chaff to train radar operators, and they took our number 1822, a lamp part, and they were going to shoot it out, and then the radar operators would be trained to separate a plane from chaff. So I looked at Robinson, and I quoted a very low price because material was on allocation, and we had the molds, and it was a big, big mold. And those days, they published the results. The guy by the name of Winsocki won the job at a price 5% or 10% above the cost of material. Impossible to do. So I said to Robinson, it's impossible. The guy's crazy. He says, he's not crazy. He says, you're not smart enough. So I said, yeah, to myself, and I walked away. About 7 or 8 years later, I'm chairmaning a session at the Society of Plastic Engineers in Washington. The guy sitting next to me, his name was Winsocki. So I said to him, are you the crazy bastard that won the job for the pellets in the et cetera, et cetera? He says, how did you know? I told him. I said, how the hell did you do it? He said, did you read the specs? I said, what do you mean specs? The part they're going to shoot out of a... No, they told you what they were going to do with it. He said, the specs called for virgin material only. So I made a mold where the runner system was 4 times the weight of the part, and I used the regrind to run my factory the whole Vietnamese war. So Robinson was right. Another interesting custom molding job happened this way. A friend of mine who worked for Plastic Toy Company, the toy company decided to make a sewing kit for kids, never realizing that a mother is not going to let a 5-year-old use a needle. So we had 5 million thimbles made out of white styrene, and it was a color we used for our lamp parts, so Monsanto adopted it as a standard color. And he asked me if I would regrind the material, use it, and pay me whatever I thought it was worth. I said, I'll pay you the value of the material net, the cost of the grinding. I start getting in 5 million thimbles, an enormous amount. I'm just about to start to regrind when a friend of mine, Buddy Lowenfeld, who was working for Cohen-Hall Marks, Cohammer Fabrics, and they had just come out with a machine washable fabric. And they had a little brown card, and they wanted to put a thimble, because in those days the washing machine was an open tongue, and imprint the word Cohammer on the thimble and give it away with anybody motion. So I quoted a Buddy a price without any mold cost, with the delivery in 2.5 weeks. The mold would take about God knows how long. And the molding was zero. And he comes back to me a few days later. He said, you're crazy. And I said, come on over for lunch. And I told him the whole story. And he gave me the order right away. And in about 3 weeks, we were producing these parts for them. All my competitors couldn't understand how I did it. I told Buddy, if they ask, show them my bills. So that was another unusual coincidence in the injection molding thing. I told you how Rialto products came to us, and I will add to that later on. I had another experience where I was less than brilliant. Tensor Lamp, T-E-N-S-O-R, was the largest selling, the first one who sold these high intensity lamps. And he was molding it in ABS, and they were getting breakage on the little connectors so that you could move the lamp around. And Marbon recommended me to him. So I went over there, he was on Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn, and I went over their engineers, and I told them I could immediately straighten out the base part, that was no problem, but you wanted to design the swivel parts.